fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Marianne Miller. Marianne is an eating disorder therapist and binge eating coach who supports clients through eating disorder recovery. Marianne joins us today to share the truth about binge eating disorder, to dispel the common myths and share some tips for kickstarting your recovery. Hello, Marianne.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's nice early Monday morning and San Diego, California.
What time is it with you? Did you say it was like 9:30?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So your day is just starting and my day has just finished.
I know. So weird.
It's so funny. It's amazing. Like, I don't know. Obviously, there are time zones and I get that and my brain can deal with that. But when I'm like talking to somebody and I'm like, how is it morning for you? I don't understand.
I know. Like, it's so bizarre.
Yeah,
it was really, really weird.
Yeah, I had the company that I work for, I do like client calls, and we had a client. The sponsor was in, I think, like West Coast America, and then the client was in somewhere in Australia. And the best time was like 7:30 in the morning for me, 11:30 at night for the American, and then 6 p.m. for the Australian, and it was. That was the best. I like went online to like see which there was like an app that would tell you the best time, and that was the only one in orange, which apparently was the best.
It's amazing. I think that's just our new reality, you know.
Yeah,
it is our new reality. It's really bizarre.
Yeah, absolutely. Now we can like, now everything's online.
I know, it's
and
great.
It allows us to do things like this for us to connect. Yay! And record podcasts together, which is awesome. So I guess to start us off, we're talking about binge eating disorder today. So mm-hmm. Would you mind explaining to us what it is?
Sure. So binge eating disorder is a diagnosis for people who binge eat at least 3 times a week for at least 3 months. And binges are typically considered eating a large amount of food, you know, compared to like typical people who don't eat this large amount of food in a very short amount of time. So eating the larger amount of food typically quickly in a relatively short amount of time. And it's these binges occur outside of holidays or big festivities that people tend to eat a lot of food. So for example, we just had our American football Super Bowl Sunday.
And
a week ago, and that is a big eating day in the U.S. Like, there's all kinds of specific foods that people eat, and so that, like, people eating a lot during that day would not constitute a binge. Binges typically happen by, you know, in isolation. People hide the binges. And then they also struggle with a sense of, you know, overwhelming guilt and shame about eating that large amount of food. And then it also comes with obsessive thinking about food, eating, and body image. Preoccupation and obsessive thoughts about food, eating, and body image.
Yeah. Now, thank you for giving that overview. And I'm really glad that you highlighted the sort of aspect around binge eating disorder isn't just like having a one-off occasion where you eat a lot of food in a day. Because I think the like society often uses like, oh, I had a binge this weekend or whatever, when you maybe just ate more than you would on a typical day. But there's so many other aspects related to it. And one thing that I thought was interesting that you said, and I completely agree with, by the way, but isn't in the DSM-5, which I always think is strange, is the, I can't remember the specific word you used, but like the thoughts around body image and weight, because I always find it bizarre that like anorexia and bulimia both say like your evaluation of self is based on weight and shape. And to me, from the people that I've spoken to that have binge eating disorder, that's still there.
But
it's not there in the DSM-5, which I think is, I don't know, to me that's almost we're going to get onto the myths in a minute, but I feel like that's a myth in itself that needs to be gone.
I agree, because I have been working with eating disorders for almost 11 years, and I have never treated anyone with binge eating disorder who has not had you know, preoccupation with food, eating, and body image is always there, you know, for people who meet the diagnostic criteria for binge eating disorder.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess just before we come on to the myths, you said that you've been working in eating disorders for 11 years. So why did you decide to specialize in this area?
So it was really two paths converging. So the first path is that I'm recovered myself. I had an eating disorder of some sort, some iteration of an eating disorder, ever since I was about like 7 or 8 years old. And so, you know, sometimes it looks like anorexia, sometimes it looks more bulimia in terms of I overexercise to compensate instead of purging. And then at the very end, for several years, it was full-blown binge eating disorder. So that was there. And then I became recovered myself, and I felt like just how amazing recovery is. And I wanted to share that with other people. So that was that aspect of it. But really, from a clinical perspective, I was
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at rss.com.
Working with a lot of people with chronic pain, and a lot of them had disordered eating symptoms. And so what I did was, I was a full-time professor at university there in Southern California, and I ended up sitting in on a class in one summer that was an eating disorders class, and I read all the textbooks and I soaked in all the research, and I realized, this is amazing. I totally want to do this. And I felt very nervous because I had stayed away from eating disorders for many years as a therapist, because I myself wasn't recovered. And so I remember at the time I was talking to my own eating disorder therapist, and I said, I don't know whether I should help people in this because of my history. And she just looked at me straight in the eye and said, Marianne, you've lived it. And I said, Oh, okay. And it has helped my lived experience, although most times I don't disclose that I'm recovered, but just I get it, and I get the struggle, and I get the mental anguish around it, that I can really convey that I understand, and people resonate with that for sure. So when I decided, yes, I want to treat eating disorders in my clinical work, I was able to attend the University of California, San Diego Eating Disorder Center's trainings that they have, because it's one of the top eating disorder centers in the world. And I was just very fortunate that I live here and I have access to that. And so for 3 years, I went to and got training from them. And then for 1 year, I was supervised by someone who had been an eating disorder therapist for many, many years. Because it was very important to me to know the research well, to get excellent training, because eating disorders are so complex to treat. So as I began to really focus on my practice, focus on eating disorders in my psychotherapy practice, I was very ready. I felt like I was very well trained, and I knew the complexities of how to treat it. And I love it. I adore my work. Like, I'm so passionate about it.
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant to hear. And I think, like you said, that element of, you know, you've lived it and you can empathize with that. Like, you're never going to know exactly what is going on for somebody or what it feels like. But I think having that lived experience does give you that sort of added layer of understanding. And I think also like that passion for it as well. You know, you've been there yourself and you needed that help. So kind of, you know, you want to give that back to people. But it's great that also you are so passionate about, you know, really knowing the research and understanding that to make sure that you're giving the right sort of treatment and care for your clients. So that's really lovely to hear.
Thank you.
When we decided to do this podcast, I reached out to the listeners because we had discussed, like, you know, talking about some myths and things like that. So we've got some myths and then also some questions from the listeners. But I wondered, you know, if we wanted to go through these myths. So I'm just gonna, you know, say before we start this that this is not what I believe in the slightest, but I think that it's really important to have these discussions because, you know, often I think people can be sitting with things and then not want to say out loud, so to actually get the facts is really, really important. So the first one, I've kind of got two that are quite similar, so I'm going to merge them together. So binge eating disorder is just an excuse for people who are greedy and people just need to stop eating so much.
Oh boy, that's very cringy. Mm-hmm. And believed by many, many people. Mm-hmm. So definitely a myth. So eating disorders are brain disorders. So a lot of researchers have conducted fMRI studies of the brain, so brain scans, to show that when people struggle with binge eating disorder, when they have binge eating disorder, and they compare the brains of people with binge eating disorders to the brains of people without binge eating disorders, they find that there are areas of the brain of people with binge eating disorders that aren't functioning as efficiently and as effectively compared to people without binge eating disorders. And so it is 100% not people's fault when they develop an eating disorder. They actually, their brain is wired to get more pleasure from food than people without binge eating disorder. And sometimes it can feel like kind of a rush, you know, when they eat the food. And then a study came out last year that shows that even in elementary school, or would that be primary school? You know, the first one to first grade, to like primary school, elementary school, they found that brains of kids with binge eating disorder are different. There's actually more gray matter in those children's brains compared to brains of kids without eating disorders. And as children's brains develop, the gray matter needs to be kind of like pared down, like kind of like how you pare an apple or a pear. You know, you kind of like carve out, you know, pieces of it or pare off the peeling of it. That's what needs to happen to the brain, and it doesn't for kids with binge eating disorder. So for people to say that it's just for people who are greedy or lazy, that is 100% inaccurate. Binge eating disorder is a brain disorder. It's not people's fault that they struggle with this. And they've likely had it since they were kids. And also there's a huge genetic predisposition, biological predisposition for people who develop eating disorders. They've conducted twin studies, and if there is an eating disorder in one twin, identical twin with the same DNA, there's up to an 82% chance that the second twin will.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
Have an eating disorder. And so the way that I see it is that people already have the biological predisposition. They're born with it. And then environmental factors can flip the switch and cause people to develop it. And for some, like teens and even some adults I worked with, it was the pandemic that triggered it. And it can be things like trauma, it could be family. Even like having a very diet culture saturated family system, it can mean like a bad breakup or bullying. I mean, growing up, many medical traumas, like many different things can flip that switch.
Yeah, that's so interesting what you were saying about the gray matter. Like, think, you know, people often don't think about the structure of the brain and how that's going to impact it. And I guess a question I have is, you mentioned like individuals will get more reward from food. So is that similar in a way to sort of like an addiction, or would food addiction be different to binge eating disorder?
Oh, that's a great question. So I don't see food addiction. I don't see binge eating disorder as an addiction. Mm-hmm. I see it as a dysregulation. Mm. So, because with an addiction, like to a substance, for substance abuse, what qualifies as an addiction is if you build up increased tolerance to a particular substance like cocaine or alcohol, like you need more of it over time to get high. And so that's not the case with food. Like food is not designed to, you need more of it to get that rush. And it's a lot more complex because with binge eating disorder, there's the binge eating cycle where if people struggle with binge eating, that means some sort of restriction has taken place. And that kind of restrict binge cycle just does not exist when it comes to substances. It's just a completely different animal. And then also with food, you have to have food to survive. You do not need alcohol to survive. You do not need cocaine or heroin to survive. And so you have to completely change your relationship with food and heal your brain through treatment in order to be able to eat regularly and not binge. And the way, the great thing is that because of neuroplasticity, because the brain can grow and develop even in midlife or and older and at more mature ages, the brain can grow and develop. And so because of neuroplasticity, you can create new neural pathways and so change your relationship with food and change your relationship with your body. And so it's just, I just don't see it as an addiction. And I think it's very reductionistic to see it that way because it's just incredibly complex because we have to eat food to survive. And so to say we're addicted to food, like we're kind of all addicted to food because we all have food to survive. So I don't want to see it or villainize food in any sort of way. And that's kind of what using the term food addiction does in my mind.
Yeah. I think often, because I've read quite a few studies recently that talk about, it always seems to be when you read in the literature, I mean, it's not always, but I've seen it more often than I haven't, is binge eating disorder, obesity, and food addiction are just like thrown together in a bucket. And there's never sort of any effort to distinguish between them. And I think this is just my kind of theory behind it, is that often when we're doing research or talking about anything, we almost want to have something that, when you said like reductionistic, is that how you say it? I don't know about it. Mm-hmm. We always try and simplify things. And I think because rationally, like I'm not an addict, but I think there's more understanding about how you could potentially be addicted to drugs and alcohol than maybe there is to something like binge eating disorder, or if we're going to say food addiction or whatever. So I think people try and kind of say, oh, it, binge eating disorder is a food addiction, because we can almost comprehend what an alcohol or a drug addiction is. It's almost like they're more, not normalized, that's not the right word, but more accepted that that could be possible. Whereas I don't know whether it is because we have such a diet culture obsessed society that it's just like binge eating disorder is a negative thing, therefore I just can't understand it.
I would say a lot of what you said is accurate. I think in addition to that, diet culture really wants us to villainize food and see that food is the issue. And that's not true. There's nothing wrong with food. There's no moral value. And in recovery, the goal is to get people to a sense of food neutrality, where they just see all food is as, neutral. Food is food is food. There's not good, bad food and bad food. There's not healthy food and unhealthy food. There's not junk food and clean food. It's just food. And I think people want a very reductionistic answer. Like, they want to see certain foods as bad. Like, sugar is a big one. Sugar, they call it sugar addiction, carbohydrate addiction. And so what that does is that the multi-billion trillion worldwide dollar diet culture and wellness culture, they want to convince you that these foods are bad so that you'll buy their product that doesn't have sugar, but really it has the fake sugar, which is actually worse for you and can mess with your hunger and fullness cues. And it can cause, say, buy our product, sign up for our program. You can't do this by yourself. You can't trust yourself. That's the bottom line. And so that's why one of the many reasons why I cringe at the term food addiction, because it's saying food is the problem. And if you tell people that food is the problem, then that just perpetuates the belief that they can't trust themselves around food. Mm-hmm. And recovery is the exact opposite. You want people to be able to trust themselves around food. You want people to be able to have whatever food they want in the house and not feel like they're going to lose control around it. And that is the whole that's the whole aim for binge eating recovery, is to help people with that I wanted to comment on. Right. You know, how they tend to group binge eating disorder and obesity. So the reason for that, in terms of the research, they group the two. The reason for that is that it all has to do with money. I mean, I don't know about like the UK and Europe or other places in the world, but in the United States, there is so much federal money, grant money poured into obesity research. And so, and there is comparatively very little money funded for binge eating disorder. So in order for researchers to get money to conduct their research, they sometimes have to couple the two. And that's any true eating disorder researcher or eating disorder professional will say binge eating disorder and obesity, they're not, it's not a pairing. There are plenty of people who would qualify as quote obese. Not a fan of that term myself, because again, it's been villainized. There are plenty of people who on the BMI would qualify as obese who do not have binge eating disorder. Many, many people. And there are many, many people, including many of my clients, who have binge eating disorder who would not be categorized as obese. Mm-hmm. I mean, you cannot judge whether someone has any type of eating disorder, including binge eating disorder, based on their body size, based on their weight. It's just, you can't. That is a myth. And the research is very, it's very political too. In the United States, it's more politically acceptable in the medical systems to study obesity, because they point to obesity as the problem for many health issues, when that's not the case. Like, really, if you dig deep into it, obesity, there's many other components that affect people's health outcomes way more than obesity does. But it's because our society is so saturated in diet culture, you know, the medical system points to obesity. And my guess is the same in the UK. And so, and that's just not true. Like, weight is truly not an indicator of health. There are plenty of people with lower BMIs who are very in poor health, and people with higher BMIs who are in fantastic health. So that is my podium. I will stay on it.
Absolutely. No, I mean, one of the myths that I had to debunk with you was that everybody with binge eating disorder is overweight. And I think you've absolutely knocked the nail on the head to say that, you know, somebody with binge eating disorder can exist at any size, as can, you know, somebody that is overweight may have binge eating disorder, or they may not have binge eating disorder. It's like any eating disorder, it can, you know, you can't look at somebody and just automatically know what eating disorder they have. But another one that you kind of touched on slightly that I wanted to come back to was that binge eating disorder recovery, which I think this always shocks people. Binge eating disorder recovery means going on a diet.
Yeah, that is often what people believe. And diets don't work. Many researchers have found that. Because they're not sustainable, and they actually create glucose deficits that can lead to people binge eating. And sometimes it's people that can sustain a diet, because I've had many clients who've gone on the keto diet. Is that a thing in the UK?
Sadly, yep. Yeah. Maybe just explain what it is, just in case people don't know.
Okay. The keto diet is a very high protein, low carbohydrate, or as low as you can get, carbohydrate diet. And that is, it's a very unfortunate diet, because we need carbohydrates for brain health. Like, that is, carbohydrates is literally how our brain functions. And so what I see is my clients who have been on months on low carbohydrate diets, they come in and they're an absolute wreck. Like, their cognitive functioning has been compromised. They're highly, highly anxious. They're struggling with depression. It severely affects their mental health. And so as soon as we slowly start adding carbohydrates, it is like night and day in terms of their cognitive functioning improves, the anxiety goes down, the depression goes down. We need carbohydrates to fuel our brain. And so so that is an example of a highly restrictive diet that has been very difficult for people to sustain. And when they do, it can have real detrimental effects. And what can happen is people can go on it for several months, and then they get into such a their body goes into starvation mode that they end up, you know, developing a very serious binge eating disorder, where they just can't stop themselves because their body is like, do not do that to me again. Mm-hmm. Our body knows, our bodies are so like amazing and intelligent, and they know what they need to do to survive. And so after having...
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
Been had these food restrictions for so long. They're like, okay, we're not doing this again, so we're going to get as much food as possible. And so what happens over time, and researchers have shown, is that it's the weight cycling, right? So people are on these diets and they lose a bunch of around the weight, and then they can't sustain them because it hurts them mentally and physically. They can be feeling dizzy. They can just feel terrible. And then, so what they do is they end up compensating for those months and months on the severe diet, and then end up binge eating. And then they regain the weight in some cases. Again, every case is different because every body is different. I look less at weight and more on behaviors. So if people are in a very restrictive place for so long because they're dieting, and then they move to a place where they're binging, clearly their body is telling me we need to be nourished. And so we focus on reducing and eliminating the binge eating.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point that you were saying there. And something I was actually having a conversation with somebody about last week in terms of, again, when I think that the diagnostic criteria for binge eating sort of needs rewriting. I'm now coming to realize when I say this. But we were talking about bulimia and binge eating disorder. And it was really interesting how, you know, in the binge eating disorder diagnostic criteria, it says like episodes of binging with the definition, but not the compensatory behaviors that are observed in bulimia. But one of the compensatory behaviors that could be observed in bulimia is fasting and restriction. And, you know, I think maybe not everybody, I don't know, I've not met every single person with binge eating disorder, but most people that I speak to when they have binge eating disorder, the binges occur after a period of prolonged restriction.
Correct. You're absolutely correct. There is restriction. So it can be restriction of food intake, and it can be restriction of eliminating certain foods in what they eat. So, for example, if someone doesn't eat very many carbs during the day, then at night they binge on carbs, that's because their brain and their bodies are telling them, we can't sustain this, you know, low carb thing. And so in the evening, we're going to make up for this. And it's so like, and what happens is that literally the first bite people take of carbohydrate, their brains and bodies are like, oh, it's like they feel the sense of relief. And that's part of the pleasure that, that people feel is that they've been restricted for those foods. And they get this, they get pleasure from eating foods after they restrict. Have you heard of Julia Child, the cook? She was an American cook, chef, and she, you know, studied in France and lived in France, and she passed away many, many years ago. But she, her phrase says that hunger is the best sauce, because when you're really hungry, food tastes better. And so, so people who binge eat, they make themselves very hungry. And so food ends up tasting better. And if they do that enough over time, it changes the brain. This is my hypothesis. And people get more pleasure out of food. Now, I think that's the nurture part of the nature versus nurture. I think people are with binge eating disorder are genetically predisposed to get more pleasure from food anyway, but this just makes it engaging in those behaviors makes it worse, because when people get into recovery, what they find is when I eat these foods that used to give me so much pleasure, I just don't get as much pleasure from them. And I said, yeah, that's kind of what you have to adjust for. And then there's a little bit of grief that's like, oh, I kind of miss the rush. I miss that. And it's like, yeah, and recovery still feels better. And then they say, oh yes, of course, it's so much better, I feel so much better, but sometimes I miss the rush. Did I answer your question? I think I went on a bit of a tangent.
I don't know whether you did, but I want to respond to what you've just said. And I think this is, I'm going to cringe when I say this, because I just want to say before I say this, that this is not what I believe. But I think that there are so many myths around binge eating sort of, and a lot of judgment. So I'm going to say it and bite my tongue, because if everyone could see me right now, I've literally got my head in my hands because I really don't want to say it, but I'm gonna, because this is what Philip Beans about. So you were saying about like restriction and you know, people with binge eating disorder, they will restrict all day or however long, and then they, it comes to the evening and then they'll binge. So isn't binge eating disorder just like anorexia with less willpower, because somebody with anorexia would be able to resist the urge?
If everybody could see her face, you're just cringing. Yes, I appreciate the cringe. Because with people with anorexia also have the biological predisposition to get more pleasure out of restriction. So, and researchers have proved that many times. And so people with anorexia, they get a dopamine boost. Dopamine is one of the pleasure chemicals of the brain. So they get a dopamine boost from restricting, versus people with binge eating and even bulimia get a dopamine boost from binging. And so it's just different brains. They, a lot of eating, like UCSD, University of California, San Diego, calls it under-controlled versus over-controlled. I don't like those terms because I think it kind of comes with a lot of judgment. So over-controlled is the anorexia and under-controlled is the bulimia and binge eating. And their hypothesis behind that is people who are over-controlled, their emotions tend to be more locked down. And it's sometimes they have a more difficult time accessing their emotions. And versus people who are under-controlled, their emotions are more expressed and overt and all over the place. And so in both cases, there's emotional dysregulation. They just present differently. I just don't like the terms over-controlled or under-controlled, because when it comes to eating disorders, it's really an illusion of control. It's not really control, because it's really the eating disorder that's controlling you, you know, in many ways. And you're not in control, although it's a perception of control. And then it all goes back to diet culture and the privilege of thinness, the privilege and the holding up and idealization of thinness. And so anorexia equals thinness in many people's brains, although nowadays there's a lot of people with atypical anorexia who aren't thin and have all the anorexia symptoms, and so except for the weight one. So I think in addition to binge eating disorder diagnostic criteria, I think anorexia diagnostic criteria needs to be addressed. And so so when it comes to binge eating disorder, is just anorexia with no willpower. Again, it's a brain disorder. It has nothing to do with willpower, and any sort of shaming and judgment around that is just, first it's horrible and it's just not helpful, because what can perpetuate an eating disorder? Shame. And there's, when it comes to binge eating disorder and bulimia too, is there's just so much shame. And the more shame that people experience, the more they're going to fall into this, into the binge eating cycle and not be able to escape. And it's a, you know, I just get so angry at, the shaming and the marginalization of people who struggle with this, and because it's just going to perpetuate the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I have so many things I want to say in response to that, so I'm going to try and calm down and just ask one at a time. firstly, I'm going to try and go in chronological order. You were saying about, obviously, they're different. They're brain disorders. You know, they're different kind of ways that affect the brain. But you mentioned at the start that you in your own experience, kind of transitioned from kind of more anorexic tendencies to bulimic tendencies to binge eating sort of tendencies. So is that, because you also mentioned about neuroplasticity, is that, do you think, because of that, you know, your brain can change and adapt over time? Or is there another reason you think that that might have happened?
That's a great question. I think it was less about my brain changing. I mean, I'm sure that was part of it, but really there were external factors that affected that. So I grew up in a very diet culture family in that the food was very restricted at home. I think on TikTok they're calling it ingredient only households where there's just not much food stocked up in the pantry. Mm-hmm. And you only have food that you need the ingredients for, because the message that you get from parents is that you can't handle yourself around the food, and the parents can't handle themselves around certain foods. And so that's the household I grew up in. You know, we basically had rice cakes and vegetables and some fruit and certain, like, quote, healthy cereals, and very little else. I just didn't have access to a lot of it until I would go to friends' houses or parties where there would be like goodies, like cookies or cakes or candy. And I would just I would eat a lot of it because it wasn't accessible. And so the restriction was very ingrained. And then I was sent the message that I needed to lose weight, not by my pediatrician, by my family of origin. And so I went on diets very young, starting at like 7, 8 years old. And then those continued to where middle school, when I was going through puberty, I was dieting, and my period stopped, it really wasn't until I got my driver's license at 16, that I was able to have access to foods that outside of the home. And that made a huge difference in my ability to eat those foods. But then I would like oscillate between binge eating and kind of rebelling against my family to restricting, where I was more in line with what my family wanted me to do. So I would just go back and forth between those two extremes. And that's what would happen. And then it wasn't until really, that's how I kind of existed. And then it wasn't until a little bit after I graduated from undergraduate university, and some things were happening in my life. There was a lot of stress, and that's when I started over exercising as a compensatory behavior. And that's what took off until several years later. That lasted through my graduate school, and it was like a month after I got my PhD, I injured my back because of the over exercising, and I could no longer exercise. And then that's when it morphed into binge eating disorder. So it was like the result of the eating disorder behaviors in addition to contextual factors. And it's just quite common.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know, I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
For people's eating disorders to change and morph. Now, it doesn't happen with everyone, but it, you know, for people who have it, like for me, like about 25 years, it's not surprising that mind changed and morphed, especially given, you know, contextual factors.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that was a question that we had from the listeners. I'm going to kind of merge two questions together, but it was asking that, does the, you know, duration of an eating disorder, so maybe having a longer eating disorder, and then also if you transition from, let's say, anorexia to binge eating disorder or whatever way round, do either of those elements mean that recovery is less likely, more difficult, or is it kind of they don't have an impact?
I would say that if people have different like eating disorders, iterations over many, many years, I have not seen any difference between that and people who just have one eating disorder. I think the only difference I've seen that in is when people have been purging for many decades. Mm-hmm. There's just something about the purging that people just get very, very used to, and it becomes difficult for them to stop. And so there's just something about the act of purging that gives them the sense of relief and release. And sometimes even people kind of get a little high from purging, that people feel like they can't cope unless they purge. And so, or sometimes they can't even eat unless they purge. So I think people who have been purging for many decades, it just takes, you just have to be in good treatment, a good, solid treatment with a qualified individual to, and a qualified team, you know, to help you. And then there's also like a lot of like teeth problems and that can come with that, and a lot of GI problems. And those can come with anorexia as well. But purging especially is very difficult for that. So I think the longer anyone has an eating disorder, the more of an effect it has on your body and on your brain. And it just takes longer to recover because it didn't develop overnight. So you're not going to recover overnight. And so it's important to be patient with yourself and patient with the process, and to trust the process when you have a team you're working with. As you and I have talked on an Instagram Live that you and I did a few weeks ago, if people run into a relapse, sometimes that is just part of people's recovery story. It doesn't make them a bad person. It doesn't mean they've suffered a moral failing. It just means that that was their recovery journey. And I tell my clients, let's just see this as a way to learn and grow more, so that your recovery is even more solid this next time, and so that you can really create, you know, these relapse prevention. You know, coping strategies and the mindset, and just like the sense of groundedness of, yeah, this recovery is solid and nothing's going to knock it off its base.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's definitely the sort of mindset I'm taking at the moment, is that, like, you know, a relapse is not failing in the slightest. Like you said, it might just be a message to say, like, okay, things seemed like they were okay, but they're not actually quite okay. And like you said, let's take this time to really build a solid foundation, implement really strong coping mechanisms, so that the eating disorder isn't something that's attractive to maybe fall back into years down the line. And something else that I've really noticed, especially recently, is that really building that identity up outside of eating disorder recovery. Because I think it's very easy to be like, I'm in recovery, and then your identity is still an eating disorder because you're in eating disorder recovery. And for me, that's something that I'm really like trying to focus in on, is building my identity outside of that, so that I'm not kind of passively, you know, I don't see the podcast as this, but when I worked in eating disorders, for me personally, it was like a way to have an eating disorder without having an eating disorder was to work in eating disorders. I'm not saying that that's the same for everybody, but for me, mm-hmm. I hadn't done all the healing that I needed to in order to get to a place where I could work in that place and not be like, well, I want that, but I can't have it. So I'm going to kind of practice it in different ways. So I think, yeah, that's a really good thing to kind of vocalize, that recovery is totally possible for everybody, no matter the eating disorder or the duration of illness. But it does take work, and it takes a lot of kind of, you know, battling with those inner demons in your head. But it can be done.
Yes, absolutely. It can be done, and it is possible, and recovery is a beautiful, wonderful thing. And sometimes that's the case, like you were saying in your situation. Sometimes people think they're recovered, and maybe there's just some things underneath the surface that either weren't attended to, or maybe, you know, your brain and your body weren't ready to attend to. You know, sometimes trauma can come up as an issue with, you know, sometimes people realize, oh, I have this trauma issue, and it was kind of buried 6 feet underground, and now it's coming to the surface, and I just didn't know it was there, and so it's triggering some of the eating disorder symptoms again. Or there's contextual issues, like I'm going through a divorce, or, you know, my child is having a long, you know, a difficult time, and then that kind of re-triggers the eating disorder. And again, it's not a moral failing at all. It's just part of your recovery journey, and more, you know, for you to learn. And for you, you're doing such an amazing job helping people through this journey and really validating their experiences, even their relapse experiences. That I think that there's, you know, this just deepens, I imagine it deepens the amount of compassion and deepens the understanding that you have, which will help people. And so if we look at our own journeys, you know, me being recovered as well, like I've gone through things that will continue to help me help people. And that is my calling. That is my purpose. And I see that in you as well, because of what you do and your podcast and your Instagram, whatever. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you. That's very kind of you.
You're welcome.
and then just to finish us off on the subject of recovery. So I'm going to merge two questions again from two different listeners. But one of them was kind of like, what kind of treatments or interventions have you seen within your clients that have like the best outcomes, which personally, I think it's completely individualized, but you might be able to shed some light on that. And then the second aspect of that question is regarding medical treatments prescribed for binge eating disorder. Have you heard of any? Do you think they're worth a while or not?
So I'm going to answer the second question first. Medical treatments as in medication?
Yeah.
Okay. So In the United States, Vyvanse, which is an ADHD medication, has an FDA, a Food and Drug Administration, a regulatory board in the U.S. They have approved Vyvanse for binge eating disorder, and because it's a stimulant, and it makes you, it affects your hunger and fullness cues. So really you don't feel hungry very much. And so so what it does is it treats a symptom, but not the roots of the problem. So when people stop taking Vyvanse, it comes rushing back. Because one of the areas of the brain that affects people's ability you know, the effects that is different in people who binge eat compared to people who don't binge eat has to do with the area that regulates hunger and fullness. That is all out of whack. And so in order to recover, you need that brain. But if you're taking Vyvanse, you can't heal that part of your brain because it further dysregulates your ability to regulate hunger and fullness cues. That said, sometimes people are suffering so much from binging, they just need a relief to get stabilized with the idea that this is not going to be a permanent solution. And so sometimes it's just like, let's give you some initial relief and then slowly work on the coping skills so that we can start cutting down and eliminating the Vyvanse. Now, the new medication, it's Ozempic, girl, I forget the name of it, Ozempic or something. It's a diabetes medication. This is the new thing that everybody's taking to lose weight because, again, it's an appetite suppression. It has not been FDA approved for binge eating disorder. It's been FDA approved for weight loss. So again, anything you do to suppress your appetite will affect that area of your brain that regulates hunger and fullness. And so again, that saying, you can't trust your own hunger and fullness cues. And so the goal of binge eating disorder treatment is to get people to learn how to trust their hunger and fullness cues. And so it is vital for people to be able to learn how to do that. But some people just want to lose weight so badly that that's what they'll do. But again, you get off of it and then the problem can rush back. Plus there's a lot of other side effects that people have to deal with. And then the first question was, remind me what the first question was.
The best interventions and treatments that you've seen.
Okay. I agree with you in that it is very much needs to be tailored to the person. Absolutely. I would say, though, people in fat bodies can and many times are undernourished.
Eating regularly and consistently is vital to recovering from binge eating. And we call it mechanical eating, and it really is the foundation of binge eating recovery. And what that means is eating regularly and consistently throughout the day, typically every 3 hours. And what that does is it really helps your digestive system, it helps your brain, it helps your nervous system, helps your blood sugar levels, helps everything. So that you won't build up a glucose deficit and end up having to binge later on that day. It also boosts mood and is just overall beneficial for recovery.
Yeah, I think you're so right about the regular eating, because not only does it do all of the things that you just mentioned, but it also gets you to a place where you're not constantly thinking about food and puts you in a position where you can actually engage in therapy and you've got the energy to do that.
And I think that is that is probably the biggest myth of it. Well, I mean, maybe not the biggest. I think they're all pretty big myths, but that, you know, all eating disorder therapies need to be about regular eating, no matter what you're struggling with, because that's how you heal your relationship with food ultimately, and your body and everything else going on around that. So thank you so much. I enjoyed that. Incredible amounts. It was so wonderful to speak to you and dispel all of those myths, even though I had to really put myself in a difficult position sometimes to say the words out loud. I should have just held up a sign to you, but then nobody would be able to know what on earth I was saying.
I'm offering a Ultimate Binge Busters masterclass. I don't know when this is going to air, but I offer it's a free masterclass. I offer them several times a year. And if you just follow me or go to my website, you can find out more information about it.
Amazing. And I'll put the details for all of that in the show notes so that people can find that nice and easy. But yeah, thank you so much.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.